If you look at deaths per gigawatt hour, it's safer than wind. It's orders of magnitude safer than any fossil fuel. It's up there with solar in terms of deaths per gigawatt hour ever. It's the second safest energy out there.
Is nuclear back? Hello and welcome to Tech First. My name is John Gutzier. Done a lot of shows on alternative energy, green sources like wind, geothermal, solar. Question is, should nuclear be in the mix? Nuclear is having a bit of a resurgence lately. To talk about why and where it might fit, we're joined by the founder and president of Nano Nuclear Energy. His name is Jay Yu. He's a serial entrepreneur and investor, as well as James Walker, the CEO of Nano Nuclear Energy. He's a nuclear physicist, a nuclear engineer. He worked for Rolls-Royce and the UK Ministry of Defense. Welcome, Jay and James.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
I am super pumped to talk about this. I mean, nuclear has a very long, very interesting history. It certainly is resurging right now. James, let's start with you. Why nuclear?
Well, why nuclear? Because no one really has a choice. I mean, if you want to move towards a green economy, you want to have a baseload energy, it's not going to come from wind and solar as much as we would like it to. If you want to move away from fossil fuels and you want a zero carbon emitting energy, nuclear is the only solution. So it's not so much that there's a resurgence because there's a renewed appetite. There's a resurgence because it's a necessity. And take, for instance, a country like Germany that had a real, noble ambition to make their economy more green and their energy system more green. And they moved away from nuclear. They ended up burning more coal and they ended up with the most expensive energy prices in the whole of Europe. Came from good intentions, bad things happen to them. Conversely, other countries in Europe, like Finland, just opened up the largest nuclear reactor in Europe. And so they went away from that sort of system, but it's a necessity. It's going to have to be part of the makeup of the future.
And so you're referring to this last winter, I think, where, of course, because of geopolitical things, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, shutdown of Nord Stream and Russian oil coming in, Europe had an energy crisis. And I heard actually in the UK, there were shops that had to close. There were astronomical bills, thousands of pounds where you didn't expect them for your energy, crazy prices. That has somewhat tailed off from now. Interesting. Jay, let's bring
I just wanted in. To also add with the UK, because you just mentioned the UK. I had a friend who owned a number of pubs and he literally went bankrupt because of the energy costs and the energy costs was surging. I think he said four times where he couldn't pay bills anymore. He had to reduce his staff. And at that point he just said, I give up. The profit margins are so small. I'm just going to walk away. So he had to close down three of his pubs in the UK.
Wow. Yeah. I've heard of similar stories as well. Super, super challenging business environment in general already. Then you add the energy part on top of that. Jay, you founded the company. Talk about why.
So 2 years ago, I was looking to invest into green energy. I was looking at solar and wind, and it didn't make any sense to me. You need the sun to shine, the earth to move, and there was no baseload energy and no innovation in that space. So when I started looking into nuclear, I said, okay, there's big nuclear, but then there's this acronym called SMR. I kept seeing SMR everywhere. There's all these YouTubers and people talking about it, and that stands for small modular reactors. So I looked into it. There were leaders in the space like Rolls-Royce, TerraPower, and NuScale. So I started researching again. These are still really big. And what really cemented me was Larry Fink, the chairman of BlackRock. He said, the next 1,000 unicorns aren't social media companies or search engines. It's green hydrogen, green cement, and green energy. And that kind of reinforced my thought process. Again, I didn't know Nano was going to turn into what it is today. But I knew I needed a rock star CEO. So I went into my network And I said, hey, does anybody know any nuclear physicists or nuclear engineers? And one of the very first guys said, yeah, I know one up in Canada. So me being an entrepreneur and me being very hands-on with how I scale companies, I immediately packed my bags, flew to Canada. I sat down with James and I said, James, you know, I know I just met you, but I have a feeling here that green energy is going to be the next big wave and momentum, and in particular, nuclear. And he thought I was crazy immediately. He said, I left countries, I changed industries, and you're telling me to go back into nuclear now? I said, yeah, exactly. I looked at his resume, worked for Rolls-Royce, big check mark, because that's what I was researching. He worked at the Minister of Defense.
And we should mention here, by the way, that Rolls-Royce isn't just automobiles.
Yes, exactly.
Big business in a lot of other things, including energy production, aircraft engines, a lot of other
stuff.
There
you go. Exactly. So then, so he had Rolls-Royce checkmark, worked at nuclear sub checkmark, nuclear physicist. I was like, he's my rock star CEO, but he's also a rare combination because I come from Wall Street, where he understands also the capital markets, because he's worked in public companies, and that combination is very rare, in my eyes, especially in the nuclear industry. So I had to recruit him, and he was basically number two of nano nuclear.
Gotcha. So James, let's come back to you. And I don't 100% agree with everything maybe you guys are saying about solar and wind and geothermal and wave and all that stuff. There are certainly some downsides to that. The sun does have to shine, but you know what? It shines a lot in Texas. It shines a lot in Australia. It shines a lot in various parts of the world, Bermuda, other places. And so there's good things there, but there also are interruptions, right? And battery technology isn't going to always do load balancing and load management. And, you know, Morocco's putting a big solar facility in place that they're going to ship energy to, you know, Western Europe. But will that always work? Will somebody cut the cable? There will be some challenges. So I do see a need for backups, for emergency access, for maybe leveling load and other things like that. Talk about your technology.
Yeah. So, I mean, just to touch on that very quickly, I mean, Jay was obviously considering, say, for instance, solar. I think one of our directors, he was Department of Energy. He invested a $2 billion investment into solar, essentially for a project where after about 3 years of operation, a lot of the materials would need a complete replenishment. It's difficult because obviously there is definitely a will to go more green. But when you are looking to try and say, for instance, in a very developed country with a very developed infrastructure and grid, baseload energy that, is the city going to be within, is the sun always shining there? If it's not, then you need to get solar from somewhere else. How are you going to transport that electricity? There's going to be losses there. Nuclear can be put anywhere. I mean, that's big
in the backyard.
Yeah, you can put it in your backyard. You know, wind is the same. I'm from the UK. There was a big investment into wind. It makes up a very, very small percentage of power structure, even though there's enormous amounts of wind available there. There's huge amounts of losses on wind power stations. Again, best intentions. It didn't pan out as much as they wanted to. And now the government is putting money back into the nuclear industry again to try and put that gap where they wanted green energies to fill. They weren't able to fill them. Have to go back to what works. And so,
sure. But a country like Norway has covered 100% of its energy requirements for entire days and good chunks of it for entire weeks or months just with wind. But you know what? We could probably have that debate offline or something like that. You want to know about your tech as well. I grant the need for something that it can be always on, doesn't require the sun to shine, doesn't require the wind to blow, doesn't require the waves to come. Can be put anywhere that you need and scale pretty quickly. Yeah. Talk about your tech and how it works. You've got two different reactor types, both named after gods, Zeus and Odin.
Yes.
Talk about those, what they are and what the difference is.
I mean, the way we came about actually this business was that we came at it from a very commercial angle, and we looked at where the largest market for this was. And what we realized is that these companies like NuScale, they were creating reactors that were essentially still 10 city blocks in size.
Yes.
It would cost $1 billion to sell these things. And what we realized actually is that if we actually produced, say, dozens of very small reactors that were very portable, that could be moved anywhere in the world, then the market was essentially infinite. Like if you look at mining operations as an example, I mean, Jay and I both have some history in that industry. Tens of thousands of mines operate just on diesel. In fact, the majority have to operate on diesel because one, there's no infrastructure nearby. So diesel, it needs to be shipped in at all times. Mining industry has made enormous efforts to try and use solar and wind to power those operations, and it's not worked. It's been a constant failure, and mining companies have had to revert back to diesel. These kind of reactors, you could insert them into these areas. It would be zero carbon emitting, and you'd be able to power a mine for 20 years without needing refueling. Once it was essentially done, or the requirements were needed, the reactor could be moved back and disassembled in a safe area at our headquarters. Mm-hmm. So this was actually the much larger market, because the capital costs of producing the reactor would be lower. The smaller you make a reactor, the fewer working parts there are. So machining and manufacturing become cheaper too. And there are even cities that have to run on diesel, like here up in Canada, Yellowknife, for instance, it runs almost exclusively on diesel. These sort of potential customers are enormous. Even Africa, which is enormously resource rich, can't access some huge amounts of it because there's large parts of the continent which are not connected to grids. These micro reactors, you could then have desalination plants, you could have medical facilities, you could access all those resources with these very small designs. Going with that in mind, that's the direction we took it. And Jay's the more connected of us, of the two of us, and he was the one who connected us with, first of all, some very specialist scientists out of California who got working on the Zeus reactor. And then secondly, we got the University of Cambridge working on the Odin reactor. Two very different designs with the same modus operandi to create a very mobile, portable reactor that was very safe, very few working parts, very conventional, very simple to design, could deploy anywhere. They met slightly different power output requirements. This is the direction we took it in.
Talk about safety of nuclear for a moment. Many of these tiny new nuclear reactor designs are designed to, and I'll use quote marks here, be impossible to fail, like impossible to have a runaway reaction and overheat. Is that the case here? Is that what you built in?
That's exactly what we went for. I mean, in terms of safety anyway, I mean, it's always worth, nuclear has had the worst PR ever in the entire history of any energy system. And that's principally because it was always attached to the government and they didn't care. They just wanted the energy. But it's, if you look at deaths per gigawatt hour, it's safer than wind. It's orders of magnitude safer than any fossil fuel. It's up there with solar in terms of deaths per gigawatt hour ever. It's the second safest energy out there. Beats geothermal, beats everything. But those are the larger reactors where you can get those runaway reactions. If you go small, you can have a passive cooling system. So even if you were to throw a grenade at it that blew up part of it, you would not need the cooling mechanisms to dissipate that heat, to prevent a core melt, to that would sort of create that that environmental hazard.
Mm-hmm.
So in our reactor, we removed pressurizing, we removed the coolant, we removed control rods, we removed working parts. Essentially, you've got a reactor that if it just, everything stopped working, the heat would just naturally dissipate.
Wow. How much power can you get from them?
So it depends on the reactor. Our Zeus reactor, which is going to be the smaller of the two, that's going to be able to produce about 1 megawatt electric. So about 2.5 megawatt thermal, 1 megawatt electric. The Odin reactor is going to be a larger reactor. I mean, that's going to be producing up around about 5 to 10, probably in that sort of range of power output.
Interesting. And so maybe the smaller is for a mine type scenario way up north or way in some remote area or something like that, drop that in There you go. In the largers, maybe for a city or a town.
Yeah, I was just going to add in, like, the Zeus reactor will essentially replace diesel generators.
Yeah,
that's the whole plan. Anything with that you have to truck back to the mining scenario, where you have to truck millions of dollars of fuel every single month to maintain mm-hmm. these mines. That's where most of these mining operations or companies fail, because they can't keep up with that type of cost.
Yeah. So I think that makes a ton of sense. And I think that works very, very well. I guess a question is, in the current environment we're in, where somebody could want to toss a grenade at something, obviously there needs to be security around these things. Do you bury them? Where do you put them? Can sure. some terrorist organization get one? Can they create a dirty bomb with one? You know, what has to be done around the infrastructure to ensure that it's safe, not just in operation, but in anything that could happen?
So, I mean, I've never really understood the dirty bomb thing, because if you wanted to create a bomb, what you'd have to do is get a reactor, take it to a multi-billion dollar chemical plant, melt down the zirconium alloy uranium fuel, extract out the uranium, then take it through a billion-dollar facility to enrich it, then fashion it into a bomb, and then deploy it. I mean, I've never
been telling you're a nuclear engineer, and I'm not.
and this is the thing, John. This is the first thing I actually asked James when I met him. I said, that's what the general public's going to ask. That's the, can this be a dirty bomb? Is this mobile reactor, can it just blow up if you do something to it? And spread radiation across the city and kill everyone. So that's one of the first questions. And James looked at me just like this. He just said, you're crazy.
I mean, I guess the most dangerous thing you could do is you could take the uranium alloy out of the reactor and hit someone in the head with it, I guess. Maybe that would really cause a concussion or something. If you throw a grenade at the reactor, you'd have a cleanup operation. You know, these things are very safe. Even big plants like Three Mile Islands and Fukushima, which are famous disasters. I mean, no one died. Yeah, it's it's very difficult to kill anybody with these. And if you go really small, I mean, it gets even more absurd. I mean, the dirty bomb, I always just thought it would be really inconvenient to have something with nuclear material and blow it up, and then everyone's got to go through the annoyance of having to sweep it all up. But yeah, It's an odd thing because it's prevalent, I think, because I think radiation is one of those things that it's easier to fear what can't be seen, as opposed to a tiger in a room, which you can obviously objectively assess the danger.
Absolutely.
I think that's a really important point, James. I think that's a really important point. I mean, I'm reminded of when I was talking to a communications engineer about 5G. And lots of people are concerned about 5G and everything like that. And he says, you know what, you get way more radiation exposure from your microwave than you would if you had a 5G station right next to your house. So that makes sense. And also, you know, I think, Jay, you made this point. Diesel kills, right? You burn all that diesel. Stuff is in our environment. We're getting particulate matter, right? And people have asthma, or people have other things. Asthma is on the rise, other things like that. Right. And so there are costs that we don't see because they're downstream and they're hidden.
Exactly.
Other
totally agree with you, John, on that. Yeah.
Talk about where you are in the process. You're developing your building. I don't believe you have an operational nuclear reactor at a client site yet.
So where we are with both reactors at the moment is that both have gone through feasibility assessments, initial physics modeling work, just to prove feasibility and that this will work. And now they're going through a detailed design phase where we're defining in detail and finalizing dimensions and material compositions, with an idea that by the end of this year, we'll have final detailed designs that will then move from that concept phase into a demonstration phase. And we already have a very good working relationship with the Idaho National Laboratories, where we'll be doing a lot of that demonstration work at existing facilities that are there. So based on the contracts we have with them. And that demonstration work is nuclear and non-nuclear test work to prove up the models. Once that is done, you have a prototype at that point. Then you can move into the licensing of that prototype.
Mm-hmm.
And during that licensing phase, that's the longest lead item, because you need to go through all scenarios, action scenarios, operational scenarios, staff, all of that kind of thing. While that licensing phase is going on, we'll be building manufacturing facilities for these reactors.
Okay. So it's not happening tomorrow, Jay.
No. It's going to take, you know, I think we modeled it to 6 to 8 years. But the main thing here is, for example, you look at other SMR companies, they've taken over a decade and also $1 billion of CapEx of investors' money. They recently did some SPACs at a $2 billion valuation. And you know, with the SPAC market and the capital markets in Wall Street right now, with all these bank meltdowns, you know, that's been slashed by half. So most of those investors that have been trapped for a decade, you know, looking at returns or losing money now, they're probably pissed. But also that's where we're going to change things. We're allowing, you know, retail investors and institutional investors to come in to a company like us, sub-$1 billion, that has two reactor concepts, that we're also getting into the fuel fabrication business, that if you want James to elaborate on that, he could take us into as well. But we have also a number of M&A strategies and plans that will take us to the next level and be the first advanced reactor technology company in revenues as well. So we're looking at this from what James said, a commercial and business standpoint, not just academic research.
Okay. Well, that's some patient money that has to go into these things, because there's a long time frame to recouping. James, that sounds interesting. Jay mentioned fuel extraction, perhaps enrichment. I'm not entirely sure. Talk about what you're doing there.
So this was actually quite important. As we worked our way up to the top brass in the United States and got in front of the head of the National Laboratories and began talking to DOE, it became quite obvious, actually, that there were some very major national capability gaps within the United States. And one of the most significant ones we realized was the fuel side. So you can have the best SMR or nuclear reactor in the world and it beats out all the competition, but you can't currently fuel it. And we saw this as an enormous opportunity for Nano to make themselves a cornerstone of the national infrastructure within the country. And so we solicited an enormous amount of reports from some of these national laboratory leaders. And we've been pursuing the design and the development of a fuel fabrication facility, which we intend to make an integrated facility with other national capabilities. But we anticipate sourcing an enriched uranium hexafluoride and fabricating all the different types of fuel forms, and then having that as a subset of our business, where we will not just supply ourselves, but we will supply other SMR companies. So whoever wins the race in the nuclear race, we will still be a business supplying them. And there's an intention there to supply the Department of Energy, the National Laboratory Systems, as well as other SMR companies. It's going
to
be a...
No, I was just going to add to what James said about you could be the best SMR, but if you don't have fuel, you have nothing. So Essentially, TerraPower is public information. I think they raised $1.3 billion in 6 months. Their lead investor was SK Group from South Korea. I think they invested $750 million of that. And, you know, right when they closed that, I think a few months later, they said, oh, sorry, we've been delayed. Because we have no fuel. And this is where me and James saw this kind of bottleneck here, and we took action to it. And we're actually moving forward with that.
It's almost a razor and blade scenario. So that makes some sense. Let's talk about...
Sorry, John, go ahead.
No, go ahead. That's fine.
No, I was just going to say, it was quite remarkable once we got more stuck into the business, just how many capability gaps are in the country that are looking to be filled now. And I think there's an enormous potential opportunity out there for Nano to expand very rapidly into these gaps that have been left there essentially by these capabilities not being renewed, money not being invested, and just no, there's no dip, there's no competition for these things.
It does not shock me in the least because of a couple of things you said and a couple of things that I know, which is that it has been a massive government project. And so you kind of do what you need to do. It's all kind of bespoke. You do what you need right now. And all of that knowledge and learning over some of those reactors, but also if we're talking nuclear, there's also weapons, has been lost as people age out of the system and there hasn't been investment in how to do things better, safer, cheaper, other things like that. And the supplementary businesses that collaborate to form an ecosystem that functions. Super interesting. Let's go fast forward. Let's say 5 years, you're faster. Somehow regulatory, regulators say yes quicker or something like that. Let's say we fast forward 5 years, you're in the market, you're shipping. What do you see the grid of the future looking like and the energy sources of the future looking like? Maybe Jay, you first.
I see, actually, there was an institutional bank one of our investors talked to, and they quoted them saying, you know, the next few decades, small nuclear is going to take market share from big nuclear, because they see all the rise of these SMR and these advanced reactors. So the tech side, just like material science, is going to get better and better. Your iPhones are getting smaller, screens are getting more high resolution, the cameras are getting more defined. So what's going to happen is the structural shift in technology is going to advance nuclear to the next level. And you're going to see all these small companies rise up, and you're looking at energy independence here, democratizing energy, being able to, for example, Hurricane Ian in Puerto Rico wiping out the island, the island's grid, and bring in like a Zeus, for example, and powering 1,000 homes carbon free. That's the disruption that's coming down in the next few decades.
And James, how does that fit in with other alternative and green energy sources?
I think there's going to continue to be this drive towards greener technology, and I think a lot more of the national infrastructure will draw its energy usage from more green energies. There's going to be a greater push for solar and wind, of course. It remains to be established how far you can take some very large countries in that direction. I mean, Norway, I don't think the population is 5 million, but it's also a very coastal city that has very has a big advantage with wind. And there's other countries that say like Iceland that could benefit hugely from geothermal. But when you have a big country like America, where you have 300 million people, you need a very diverse set of ways to source energy from. And when you're looking for baseload energy, if you're going to move away from natural gas, fossil fuels, it could only be nuclear on that front, because it is essentially an energy source you can put anywhere. Nuclear will make a big resurgence. It will make up more of the energy grid than it does currently. That's for certain. How much we retain in terms of fossil fuels will yet to be seen. They are very persistent, and something like natural gas, I think will continue to form probably part of a very large energy supply to major industrialized countries. They will just continue to do that.
It's really interesting if you look at things as a system. And so fossil fuels, that system has been with us for decades and decades, right? And so you mentioned natural gas, right? Well, there's pipelines. There's places where they pump it out of the ground. There's refineries. There's pipelines, and it gets to a place. And that perfectly suits kind of the grid, the way we've built it, sort of a hub and spoke model, right? Where power generation is centralized and it's spread all over the place. Your solution kind of fits into that pretty well, because somebody could potentially take your larger reactor, put it down on the same place where they have, let's say, a natural gas power plant, right? And just flip the switch in some sense, right? It's interesting because there was, I forget, I think it was in the States somewhere recently, but it could have been somewhere else, but it was in the last month. There was an energy crisis because of storms or inclement weather or something like that.
You talk about California. California.
Probably.
Yes.
And some of the contractors, they were contracted to have supplementary capacity that they could bring online quickly, right? And they did not. They could not. And so they've been fined for that. Is that not correct?
That was California. Yes. For some of the engineers I work with, some of the nuclear engineers, they were involved in trying to remediate the situation in California because they did not have that strength in depth to supply energy when there was a deficit. It was a major issue.
Interesting. I'm actually in Vancouver, Canada myself, but I know from many of my friends in the Bay Area and California, other places, it seemed like a third world country in some cases over the past couple of years, because they've had brownouts and power failures and all these things, you know, that have been quite significant.
Yeah, that's right. And you actually just made me think of something too, is that as there's this push for electric vehicles, if you imagine when you're driving across the country, you have very remote gas stations and to obviously fill up the car. The difficulty is that you would need some sort of electrical charge station if you do want to continue, if we do want to continue a drive in the electric car direction. But this would actually mean having to ship in generators or generate electricity through fossil fuels to replace these systems. Like if we did actually have one when these nuclear reactors are ready, you could have a charge station absolutely anywhere you wanted. And you could fuel these electric cars anywhere in the world. And you could then have a feasible situation where you could replace the grid and you could replace every single car and not need a fossil fuel car.
Interesting.
To say transport long distance.
John, just to add to what James said, we actually have a cult following on Twitter, and Elon Musk is very pro-nuclear. And he tweeted one day, I think, we need nuclear. And then we kind of retweeted his tweet, and we said, you know, imagine Elon, a Zeus powering 50 of your Tesla cars at once. And then I think we got 1,000 new followers from him because of that, because they all started going crazy with it. So that's how viral this is. This could become just the idea, but just don't stop there too. You know, you think of space, right? How we could go deeper into space.
We're going to be on the moon very soon. We're going to be on Mars. Not
you're
too
gonna
far
need,
from now. How are you going to power that? Absolutely.
And space exploration, you could look at too. But also looking at even the shipping, disrupting shipping as well, right? The shipping across the world, you know, burns so much fossil fuels. Imagine we could replace every engine there. You talk about trains as well. So the total addressable market of this is enormous. Sometimes I don't even think it's billions. I think it's trillions.
Well, this is kind of Jetson stuff here with the nuclear powered cars and we'll get there.
I'm sure another 50 years or something.
Yeah.
We'll James, I want to ask you if you go to one of those cities that is currently powering their grid on diesel or natural gas, and you say, hey, I've got this solution here. 20 years before you need any servicing or anything like that, any new fuel. What's the cost differentiation here between the existing system that they have and the system that you're offering? Are we talking half the cost? Are we talking the same cost? Are we talking 10% of the cost? Are we talking twice the cost? What are we talking about?
So we have tried to do a very in-depth analysis, as you would have expected, on the anticipated cost and how it relates to other fuel forms and other energy supply. What we realized actually is that I think NuScale put out an estimate and then immediately changed it the next year, and it was almost 50% larger. And that's because they didn't actually have a very good idea, because the costs, the things that feed into that cost estimate can vary so much. But I can't remember what institution did it. I believe it was a major investment bank. When they took into account energy costs over the time it was deployed, plus the, if you take away the subsidies that the fossil fuels are getting, and you look at the continent upon which the energy is being supplied, then in Europe, nuclear would be commensurate with gas. And in the United States, it was commensurate, I believe, with coal. And so that's the sort of energy you're going to get, the energy sort of cost that nuclear will approximate, given time for deployment and the maturity of the technology.
And just for context here, coal is the cheapest form pretty much because it's pretty abundant. It's also super dirty. Nobody likes it. It's dirty to mine.
The
it's
dirtiest,
dirty to handle.
Yeah.
Dirty to transport. It's dirty to burn. It's just dirty. And so that's the cheapest form. Interesting. Interesting. Okay. So you're not talking way less cost, but you are talking about the cost of the cheapest fossil fuel. And I guess one other thing that's kind of important here, and it harkens back to our conversation about pubs in the UK. You also probably get some sort of cost certainty going forward for the next 20 years. You know what you'll be paying versus if you're using fossil fuel over the past 5 years, you've been on a roller coaster.
That's
you've
right.
You've really been on a roller coaster.
That's right.
Gas went way the heck up.
Yeah, so yeah. You're absolutely right. And it's very interesting to see what, as the world becomes more polarized, actually, how those costs are affected. Certainly, we're looking at a much more polarized world where there's much more energy competition, especially with regard fossil fuels, where you can essentially leverage your possession of those things for political gain. And we've seen that already. Nuclear, I mean, you're never going to run out of fuel. And once it's in a reactor, you know exactly what the costs are going to be for 20 years. And nothing that happens globally will affect that cost. That's a major benefit. Energy security will become an increasingly important consideration for most countries. And this is going to be a way to provide energy security for anybody.
Especially countries that have people who can be voted out by people who are pissed off because energy is costing them more.
Oh, 100%.
Exactly.
Yeah, 100%.
Exactly.
Well, Jay and James, I want to thank you for taking some time. I do think our future includes a lot of solar, includes a lot of wind and a lot of hydroelectricity, which is in British Columbia, Canada, where I'm from, we have a lot. I do think nuclear has a role to play. And I do think that some of the new forms of nuclear, these small nuclear reactors that cannot overheat, cannot blow up, cannot melt down just by design, have a role to play there. Thank you so much for this time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.